Your Honors, there are, as the Court's well aware at this point, four different assignments of error. I think the Commonwealth raises fairly the question of whether the fourth assignment is one where the harmless error standard may apply, and I think that that's certainly a point worthy of consideration, and I'm not going to belabor the point on it beyond the extent of briefing we've already had. With respect to speedy trial, on brief, I relied pretty heavily on the argument in the Balance case, and I think as I continued
on the speedy trial issue, and correct me if I'm wrong, it seems that there's a dispute more or less on the calculation of the time and to whom the time should be attributable to. And it seems, as I read the Commonwealth's argument in this case, that they suggest, and they seem to have case law to support them, that during the time that you had the pending motion to suppress and the adjudication of that motion to suppress should count towards your time.
I think that they found cases where it is true that the filing of motions has told speedy trial, but there's also the case law that I cited too that says ordinary and customary motions should be handled within that speedy trial time frame. And I think it's worthy of note that in this case, the motion
that were the case, suppose, for instance, you filed your motion to suppress or any kind of preliminary motion for preliminary trial 7 days before speedy trial was due to run, and the trial judge took 9 days to resolve it. Are you saying that that time should not count against you?
I'm saying that in that case, that may well be, but in this case, I filed on the day of the grand jury. This motion was filed the day of the grand jury, and
given the nature of the motion, as I understand it, didn't it really go to whether the various conviction documents were sufficient? It really wasn't a matter of whether it was sufficient to prove the prior convictions. And so no motion was necessary ahead of time. You could have just argued all of this at trial.
It was absolutely an issue that could have been addressed at trial. I wanted to address it promptly because
it would change a lot of how the Commonwealth proceeded if they knew whether or not they could introduce those.
Mr. Turner has exactly those two possible priors. If the felony was inadmissible, the Commonwealth would not be able to find any other prior that could have established the felony. And so I thought that it would benefit everyone to know what the ruling was going to be. That being said, the flip side of that is that a lot of pretrial motions are required to be filed in advance and are required to be addressed in advance, and this isn't one of those.
It's more in the nature of motion limiting as opposed to motion suppress. Right.
And so I don't know how that's going to affect the Court's decision about its applicability towards speedy trial, but because it was filed on the day of grand jury, my position is that even if the Court doesn't entirely accept my assertions about Balance, saying that everything up until the first trial date is not a continuance with respect to the code, that at the very least, the time up until the first appearance in court pending trial, that the time between the filing and that first motions date should not count against the defendant for speedy trial.
Am I correct in reading this that on April 15th, which was the first time a trial date was to be selected, speedy trial had already run, or at least the five-month period.
The five-month period had elapsed before we ever got around to scheduling a trial date.
So did the Commonwealth make any effort during that five-month period to bring this matter back before the Court?
Your Honor, my recollection of those events isn't clear, and I think the case law says we're supposed to
record. Does the record indicate that any attempt was made to bring the case?
I can't think of anything that I can recall within the record that demonstrates a specific effort on the part of the Commonwealth, particularly any time after the issuance of the court's letter opinion explaining why my motion was going to be denied. I think that was February 16th. I don't think any time after February 16th you see a single filing until I think the court's record may include some, there may be some emails about when we need to get scheduled, and I don't even know if those are part of the record or if that's not.
But the nature of the motion itself, given that it could have been argued at trial, this is something that didn't need to be resolved ahead of trial. In fact, in a large number of cases, anything in the nature of a motion in limine, you bring it on before trial and the court says, well, I'm going to have to hear the evidence in the context of the trial to make that determination.
That is probably so, yes, Your Honor. I wanted to raise it as early as I could.
Not faulting you for raising it.
The thing that goes with that also, Your Honor, is that that sort of ties into the sufficiency question, which is to say that at the time of the motion to strike and when addressing my request for reconsideration, the court relied pretty heavily, I think, on the evidence from the pretrial hearing, which...
But getting back to Judge Russell's question, isn't your decision to file the motion in limine, and I'm not questioning your decision, in the nature of a strategic decision in the course of litigation, and let me elaborate on that. If you had been successful on your motion in limine, it is reasonable to conclude that the Commonwealth would have been very much hamstrung in their ability to go forward in the case, which may have resulted in a dismissal or a null pros or something which would have resulted in the case being done for your client.
I think that had the motion prevailed, I think that very likely what would have happened is that we'd have come in and entered a guilty plea on the lesser included misdemeanor.
And so I'm thinking that in my role as a former defense attorney, I'm sitting down with my client and saying, look, you know, we can make this play. It's playing poker. We can go ahead and file this motion, and if we win, you're going to be in a much better position, and we may be able to put most of this behind us. But if we lose, theoretically, this time to resolve this issue could be charged against us and thus put us in a bad situation as far as the implementation of any speedy trial rights that we may have. See where I'm going?
I see where you're going.
Yeah. You don't want to go there?
I don't want to discuss what I may or may not have told my client.
Right, right.
But I certainly understand that there would be, that is a consideration worth looking at. I think that the court's reliance on the pretrial motion testimony, right? My motion was not, this is inadmissible because the facts don't support it. The motion on its face was very clearly about whether or not the Commonwealth should be allowed to use extrinsic evidence. I don't know.
Well, and given that there's no doubt conviction documents were about your client, whether they actually established the necessary facts to carry the Commonwealth's burden of family member and conviction, all of those documents. I mean, it seems to me that your motion actually conflated two different issues. One is admissibility and the other is sufficiency. Your argument really is that these documents, although they are potentially relevant because they do involve my client, in and of themselves on their face aren't sufficient to support the charge.
So I
actually don't think your motion could have been resolved pretrial.
So my motion pretrial was entirely, as I intended it at least, what it says and what I meant don't always perfectly correspond, but the pretrial motion was that because they will not be permitted to address this with extrinsic evidence, it should not be admissible. And so reliance on what that extrinsic evidence might have been that was adduced at the pretrial hearing, I don't believe that necessarily comes in as part of the trial evidence. Similarly, if I'd filed a Fourth Amendment search and seizure motion in a drug case and the Commonwealth had proved that the lab said that they were that what was found was cocaine pretrial, I don't know that that would be sufficient for the trial court to then hold beyond a reasonable doubt that it was cocaine based only on evidence at trial that did not include the certificate or the lab analysis. I think similarly here, there was nothing in the actual course of the trial that proves the timing of the family or household relationship. And even if I manage to blow speedy trial entirely for my client, I do think that the sufficiency question here is one on which remand and reduction would be appropriate. And it looks like I have just about exactly those 5 minutes I asked for left, and so I'll leave it for the Commonwealth.
Thank you,
Your Honors.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Lauren Campbell on behalf of the Commonwealth in this appeal. This appeal has a number of issues, as the Court is aware, the speedy trial issue, the evidentiary issues, and the sufficiency issues. Based on the Court's questionings, I'm happy to start with the speedy trial issue.
Do you agree with the trial judge's calculation of the time?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe the Commonwealth's position is that the time of the pendency of the defendant's motion should not toll against the Commonwealth because the defendant was essentially the moving party that necessitated.
Let me ask a question.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Let me ask a question another way. I did my own counting, and I came up with a different number than the trial judge, even considering your theory of the case. So you are adherent to the number that the trial judge came up with.
Yes, Your Honor. I'm not sure what your calculation may be, but when I did the calculation myself that I included in the brief, mm-hmm. taking away the from the dates, the prelim hearing was on October 14th, 2015, and running that time against the Commonwealth till November 23rd, 2015, when the motion is filed. We have the act of God that continued the hearing on January 22nd, and then the hearing on the motion, defendant's motion, was on February 8th, and the order was not entered until March 11th.
Ms. Campbell, if we were to accept your argument that every motion filed by a defendant in a criminal case automatically tolls the running of speedy trial, we wouldn't have a 5 or 9 month rule anymore, because virtually every trial has some type of pretrial motion filed.
Your Honor, I don't believe that is the Commonwealth's argument in this case. I think it is very dependent on what the motion is, as this trial court acknowledged that this motion was important to this case because it would reduce, it determined whether or not the Commonwealth would continue.
How about every drug case in which there's a motion to suppress filed? Those motions are important because it determines whether the evidence is admissible or not. And your argument would mean that virtually every drug case, we would have to extend that 5 month period, that it would toll the running of speedy trial. And I don't see anything supporting that. I mean, the case law that you're relying on are cases where the delay was provided solely for the defendant's benefit, a request for a mental examination, for instance. But in Stinney, the court was clear that delays that are that the time limit is extended only when such delays are not inherent in the orderly process of fixing a trial date. Here, there was nothing to prevent the trial court or the Commonwealth from fixing a trial date, even though the motion was pending.
I would disagree with that, Your Honor, based on the trial court's own statements in this case that, and similar to what Judge Russell is saying, that this case, this motion could have been heard on the date of trial. But actually, the record refutes that because the trial court heard the motion and then took almost 2 weeks to issue an opinion. And the trial court said at the end of the hearing that he needed more time in order to review this matter. And the defendant did not object to that.
But don't you want a toll from the period that the motion was filed?
Yes, Your Honor.
So what does the period from the time the motion was filed? Let's assume, for instance, that you're correct. We say, okay, the speedy trial was told between the time the motion was heard and the time the motion was decided. You still lose on that with that calculation, don't you?
In my head, quickly, I believe that that would be true. However, that part of the record is what shows that this motion that the defendant filed, that the defendant instigated, should be attributed to him, because
Ms. Campbell.
Yes, Your Honor.
Given the nature of the motion, as I understand it, no motion had to have been filed at all. This could have just been an evidentiary objection at trial. Isn't that correct? There was no requirement that he file this ahead of time.
While that may be true, Your Honor, that doesn't stop the fact that the defendant in this case did choose a certain tactical decision that I think the Commonwealth believes he should be held to.
But you've conceded that only certain types of motions, when filed, toll speedy trial. if it is something for which no motion is necessary and definitionally can be raised as an objection at trial, isn't that exactly what cases like Robb's talk about in the Stinney case that Judge Petty cited, the type of thing that's inherent in just the trial process? I mean, if I could have waited until the day of trial, even if then the trial judge took 2 weeks to do it, I mean, that's part of trial. And that's something that has to happen within 5 months if he's incarcerated. Why doesn't that control? The type of motion that this was such that no motion needed to be filed, the evidentiary objection could happen at trial, and therefore it is a normal part of the trial process and has to occur within the 5 months.
Certainly, I understand your position, Your Honor, but the Commonwealth would assert that because the defendant chose to file the motion, he chose to complicate the case for whatever tactical reason, perhaps he was trying to win.
He's penalized for giving the Commonwealth a heads up?
Your Honor, I believe that it could also be seen that he was trying to get this reduced prior to trial to the misdemeanor so they could perhaps work out a deal.
Why did that motion, this case was never set for trial. So therefore, the motion could not have caused a continuance. There was no trial date to continue. Why did this motion require a delay in the proceedings?
Unfortunately, from the record that is submitted on appeal, I cannot see why this was never set for trial or how even the hearings that were scheduled ended up being set. I believe there was off the record some sort of email system that the court was using to set these. Unfortunately, we can't see that in the record here.
But to follow up on Judge Petty's question, there's no reason that grand jury returns the indictment, the motion is filed. There was no reason that on that day itself the court couldn't have said, okay, let's set this for trial 3 months from today, and I just want to make sure y'all have the motion heard a month before trial or 2 weeks before trial because I may need some time. That all could have happened.
Certainly, Your Honor, and I do understand that that would have been a cleaner record, but I still would argue that in this case, just because that did not happen does not mean that the time during which the defendant's motion was pending should not run against
him. Can you distinguish Robb's versus Commonwealth?
Yes, Your Honor. I think I'll basically end up repeating myself, but I think in that case, the court found, I need to actually look at my notes, that it wasn't. I'm sorry, Your Honor, I don't think I can actually do Rob's justice based on my notes.
To me, it's pretty much on point. The court said nothing in the record shows that the filing of the motion necessitated the slowdown of the judicial process. And then it went on to say, because the case had not yet been set for trial and the filing of the motion did not necessitate a continuance of the trial date, as in Stevens.
Certainly, Your Honor, but as I've already said in this case, I don't think that it is dispositive that the trial date wasn't set. Certainly, it would have been a cleaner record as...
A logical extension of your argument, and then this is, I think, what all favors are driving at, is that theoretically, if a defendant filed a motion for discovery during the course of the, and let's assume in that case that a trial date had actually been set, you know, you file a motion for discovery and the trial judge doesn't enter the order until 3 weeks out, would that time be calculated against the defendant?
No, Your Honor. The Commonwealth completely agrees that a motion for discovery is one of the motions that the case law contemplates should be done in the ordinary course of business.
So if we have a motion that is not your traditional motion to suppress, and I think that that's what we're driving at, is those motions to suppress are determinations by a defendant that they want a determination as to regard to constitutional issues, and it may take time, and there's a requirement under the statute that you file them 7 days in advance of trial and all of this stuff. Those kinds of motions are looked at different than what I consider your customary and boilerplate motion for discovery, motion for a bill of particular, motion to eliminate, exclude evidence, those kinds of things. And so where is the line that you would suggest that we draw for distinguishing between those customary utilitarian motions, for lack of a better way of putting it, and those motions that we are concerned with that should be calculated against the defendant?
I think the line is where Stevens discussed, where it is because of the defendant's motion necessitates a continuance. And I understand that there was not a continuance on the record in this case. However, if hypothetically the court had set a trial date and gotten to the trial would not have been able to go forward without this motion having to be decided prior.
Why couldn't it have gone forward?
Because this motion needed to be resolved prior to trial.
Why did it need to be resolved prior to trial? Couldn't the court have said, I'm going to reserve deciding this case until I hear the evidence? What would have prevented the trial from going ahead?
Well, Your Honor, I do think it's important to note that in this case, the trial court determined that this was a complicated issue that needed to be resolved and took 2 weeks to write an opinion letter on the issue. It wasn't...
The document is conditionally admitted while I take under advisement the motion for its exclusion. That allows the trial to go forward, doesn't it?
Certainly, Your Honor, if a trial court had made that factual determination.
That's not a factual determination. That's a legal procedural determination.
I know.
And we get to look at that one de novo.
In your brief, you note that the responsibility rests with the defendant to object to changes in dates and continuances, which I agree with. But then you go on to say it is of no concern that the trial date had not been set because the date could not be set until the defendant's exclusion issue was resolved, and you cite Heath. I don't see Heath as standing for the proposition. Why couldn't at least a trial date be set?
Your Honor, I'll probably continue to repeat myself, but it is the Commonwealth's position that the trial date could not be set because of the importance of this.
I thought you answered my question that the trial court could have on day one, on the day of the return of the indictment, set a trial date for 3 months out and said, I want your motion heard at least a month before trial. That was available to both the court and the Commonwealth.
Certainly, Your Honor, but it would not have been a trial court date that would have likely stood. And I understand.
Why not? If the motion is heard a month before trial and it took him 2 weeks, what would have caused it? And we've talked to you some about motions to suppress. It seems to me, obviously, a motion to suppress is less like a motion, although they occur in the normal course. It actually dramatically, it's not just a pure evidentiary thing. There are other issues that are being resolved.
Mm-hmm.
But they're heard on the day of trial all the time. In fact, that may be as common as them being heard separate from trial. If that type of motion can be heard on the day of trial, why couldn't this have been heard on the day of trial? Even though often at the end of the trial, when a motion to suppress is heard on the day of trial, the trial court says, I'm taking the matter under advisement and I'll advise you of my ruling on the motion to suppress in the trial at the same time. I mean, that happens, right?
Yes, Your Honor. Again, in this case, and I think in cases where the defendant tactically chooses to file a motion to suppress and a motion in limine and to have a separate hearing on it, that time should run against the defendant.
Can you tell me, counsel, in Augusta County, I've never practiced there, what is the process for setting trial dates? My experience in most jurisdictions is that an indictment issues, you show up after the indictment issues, and you set a trial date. What is the process in Augusta County, if you know?
I apologize, Your Honor. I do not. I am not aware.
So people are indicted, and they just sort of float?
Again, Your Honor, I do not know.
Okay.
If I could briefly turn to the evidentiary issue that was decided by the motion in limine, both Commonwealth's Exhibit 1A and 1B, briefly, they clearly state on their face that the defendant was actually convicted of the assault and battery on the family member when you take both documents together, and the Commonwealth's 2A, 2B, 2C, and 2D were an unlawful wounding conviction, were an element of the offense.
Well, even if they didn't establish that, they move the ball at least a little bit in that they show some level of conviction of the defendant, and therefore they were admissible regardless. Whether they were sufficient is an entirely separate question. Whether they were admissible, there's almost no question.
Certainly, yeah. The Commonwealth would agree with that, Your Honor. And turning to the sufficiency issue, the Commonwealth introduced the two predicate offenses, the victim in the unlawful wounding was the same victim in this case. She testified that she had a relationship with the victim and she had two children in common with the victim. Even if you remove the stipulation that they had a relationship at the time of the unlawful wounding was only 2 years prior to the indictment in this case, where it was the same victim that the defendant has two children in common with. So it was a reasonable inference for the trial court to find that at the time of the unlawful wounding, the defendant also had a familiar relationship with Molly Shiflett.
It would also be your position that the fact that the prior offense that the defendant was convicted of did not require as part of its necessary proof to show that it was indeed a family.
Certainly, Your Honor. There's no element in unlawful wounding that the Commonwealth needed to prove at that time that Molly Shiflett was a family member. Therefore, the Commonwealth needed to do it now when introducing it as a predicate offense.
In the indictment itself, did it make reference to Molly Shiflett?
Yes. Her name was in the indictment. Thank you, Your Honor. So we'd ask that you affirm.
Mr. Anderson, the General Assembly clearly intended the crime of malicious wounding to be a predicate act for purposes of third offense domestic assault, did it not?
I think the General Assembly...
The words are in the statute.
Yes, they certainly include unlawful wounding.
How could the Commonwealth prove that a prior malicious wounding... the victim of the prior malicious wounding was a family or household member if it could not introduce collateral evidence?
So I will be candid with the court that the reason I filed this motion the very first time in juvenile court was that once upon a time I was an assistant Commonwealth's attorney and I was advised at a training somewhere that, by God, you may as well indict it specifying that they're a family or household member to keep some jerk from doing the exact thing that I decided then.
Are you self-identifying as the jerk in this case?
Yes, Your Honor. That someone will try to make life difficult but by raising this objection. And I said, well, it is an objection that someone somewhere has worried about and I may as well, you know, air it out. And I think that there is a certain degree of ambiguity in that code section in the sense that it doesn't say, you know, that it has to be a conviction against a family or household member, but whether that has to be part of the record on that is unclear. And
even if you put that language in an indictment, that would be surplusage because it's not an element of the offense. So why would that be preclusive in determining whether that person was a family or household member? You'd be looking at the verdict, not the indictment.
Your Honor, I'm an optimist. I can't give you a concrete answer off the top of my head.
You practice in Augusta County, obviously.
So our office is in Stanton. We cover Stanton, Augusta, Waynesboro.
Explain to me the indictment process in Augusta County.
So on the day the grand jury sits, counsel for both sides in the court meet in chambers and typically set a trial date. In this case, rather, a motions date was set. And typically in a case, you know, for instance, if there's a direct indictment where the person isn't promptly served, what happens is that the court has various scheduling dates throughout the year. I don't know how many per term off the top of my head. I've only been there a couple of years.
So if a person is indicted under traditional circumstances, not a direct indictment, that they've gone to a preliminary hearing, and they come up and the grand jury hears the case and they're indicted, what happens next in Augusta?
Say, the court, the Commonwealth, and the defense attorney meet in chambers and set a trial date.
When?
On the day of the grand jury.
Okay.
And on that day, the defendant, the day or the day after, depending on who their representation is, the defendant shows up at the courthouse and signs a recognizance slip to appear on their trial date.
So on that date, when you showed up to set the date for the trial, instead of setting a trial date, you set a motion in limine.
We set a motions date, yes, Your Honor.
Okay, so there was never... Could you have set a trial date?
I imagine we could have, but the... You know, we set the motions date, and neither the court nor the Commonwealth nor I, you know, again, it's not in the record, but I don't recall specifically demanding one. I don't.
Okay. I'm just curious, a little different.
Going back to your evidentiary argument about the inability to use extrinsic evidence. How do you square that with our statement in Farmer that, quote, under settled Virginia law, prior convictions may be proved by any competent evidence?
Not very well, I'm afraid, Your Honor. I think
we appreciate your candor.
I note also counsel relies reasonably heavily on Heath, but Heath was a motion for a psych evaluation, and those are actually specifically outlined as one of the things that tolls speedy trial. And if my memory serves, Stevens is also a psych case, and those, again, definitionally in the code toll speedy trial in the way that this motion we submit does not.
All right. Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you very much. We agree, counsel.